Hi, I'm Rebecca Davis.
And I'm April Fulton. This is Your Health, the weekly podcast from NPR Science Desk.
On this week's podcast, it turns out jogging doesn't necessarily cause knee pain.
And 100-year-old posture lessons might be just the thing to prevent back pain.
Plus, April has been following a controversy surrounding food dyes.
That is true. And as always, we'll check in with our health blogger, Scott Hensley.
But first, you might have noticed, and have noticed this for quite a while, that there's a lot more twins running around these days. And while twins do occur naturally 2% of the time, fertility treatments have increased the number of twins born each year dramatically.
In fact, for those who get pregnant with fertility treatments, the rate is more than 40%. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports on mounting concern over the dramatic rise in twins and new efforts to curb it.
They are cute. Five sets of twins clamber among a sea of toys in this Maryland basement, a party play date their moms call a twinapalooza. Sharon Bernstein says matching outfits and double everything do turn heads.
Women always say, oh, you're so lucky you have twins. I wanted to have twins, and I always go, are you crazy?
Three of these moms, including Bernstein, used fertility treatment. And what they acknowledge, looking back now, are the incredible risks they took in their drive to become parents. Risks that posed a danger to themselves and their children. Bernstein struggled through many years and multiple rounds of in vitro fertilization trying to conceive.
I was so focused on just getting that positive pregnancy test. I really couldn't think past that event. But as soon as I was pregnant, it was like, now what? The risks and the downfalls of a twin pregnancy? No, that was completely a blindside.
Yet the downfalls are well documented. The human uterus is designed to carry one baby. When it's stuffed with two, any number of things can go wrong. And odds are the babies will be born prematurely.
When they transferred the embryos, one of them implanted in a very bad spot. There weren't enough blood vessels. So I was on bed rest for 10 weeks.
Bernstein delivered her daughters frighteningly early, 8 weeks premature. One weighed less than 2 pounds. Donna Shimshi remembers the anxiety with her own twins and the unbelievably big bills.
Within the 4 weeks before my twins were born, I was in and out of the hospital, plus them in the NICU for 6 weeks and 9 weeks, plus my C-section and everything was over $600,000 that the insurance company paid.
The cost to the system is enormous.
And Barb Kulura feels responsibility for that. She heads Resolve, the National Infertility Association, which advocates for patients and lobbies insurance companies to cover fertility treatments. She says most twins end up just fine, but some face a lifetime of problems: developmental, cognitive, respiratory, digestive, trouble with sight and hearing. Twins, Kulura says, are far more likely to have cerebral palsy.
Doctors know that. Neonatologists know that. Pediatricians know this. OBGYNs know this. Everybody knows this except for the patients.
Yet it's the patients who make the crucial decisions in fertility treatment. And in the case of in vitro fertilization, or IVF, twins are entirely avoidable.
Right now I'm loading my needles that will hold my egg and house my sperm.
In IVF labs like this one in Rockville, Maryland, clinicians have gotten really good at choosing which eggs and sperm to combine and coaxing them to produce that miraculous nugget of life, the embryo. This makes a difference when it comes to deciding how many embryos to transfer or put into a woman's uterus.
10 years ago, we would hedge the bet.
Dr. Robert Stillman is medical director here at Shady Grove Fertility Center in Rockville.
Because the likelihood of any one embryo implanting and bringing about pregnancy was low enough that you could put two or three or four, and most of the time, you didn't get multiple pregnancies. But now, as the pregnancy rates per embryo have so increased, now you have to put far fewer.
The American Society for Reproductive Medicine now recommends using just one embryo for many women. But Stillman says, try convincing someone desperate to become a parent.
We are always feel like we're at loggerheads with the patient. We get the pushback every day, every single day.
One big reason is money. IVF is expensive, $12,000 to $15,000 or more for one attempt, and it's not covered by most insurance. Like anyone who gambles, patients can be seized with a sense of all or nothing. Stillman also finds an alarming shift. As more people see twins all around, patients show up at clinics thinking they'd like twins too. But he says they're only seeing the happy, healthy twins.
I think if they saw the twins instead of in the park, saw them in the intensive care nursery or in the special needs educational fora, they might think differently. And that's a tough message to give to somebody who's just trying to have a family.
I decided to do two. It didn't even occur to me to do one.
Julie is 37, a single woman. She doesn't want to use her last name to protect her own privacy and that of her unborn children. Julie was inseminated 5 times with donor sperm to no avail, then followed a failed round of IVF. By the time of her second IVF, she figured she'd never get pregnant. When her doctor said she'd have nearly the same chance with one embryo as with two, she says it just didn't make sense.
It's a really emotional process, and you invest a lot, and it's frustrating, and it's hard. And it seemed intuitive to me that there was a greater chance with two. If I'd only transferred one and didn't get pregnant, I think I would have regretted not having transferred two.
Now, Julie is 5 months pregnant with twins. She says she understands the risks of a twin pregnancy and prematurity. After all, she's a doctor. She vaguely remembers talking about the risks with her fertility doctor.
I asked lots of questions, but I wasn't concerned about that.
Julie's friends all said if they were in her place, they'd transfer 2 embryos. In fact, 2 good friends have twins. Julie feels confident she can handle 2, and she's excited about it.
I'm someone who wanted more than one child, and I would have wanted to have a second child anyway. So that means I wouldn't have to do this again.
Dr. Stillman says he understands all this, but it doesn't change his message. It's safer to have 1 baby, and using 1 embryo in IVF has nearly the same success rate as 2. So if even informed women like Julie have what Stillman calls some level of denial, what to do? For one thing, punch up the message. Stillman is teaming with the advocacy group Resolve to put their warnings in a patient's voice.
Sorry we haven't been in touch sooner, Dr. Liu, but the girls really threw us a curveball.
Soon, patients at Shady Grove, the nation's largest fertility clinic, will be required to watch this video before undergoing IVF. It's the true story of a patient.
The girls were born at just over 25 weeks, each weighing in at a little less than just 2 pounds. Being so premature, there have been a lot of challenges.
The woman tells how one infant had surgery, how they spent the better part of 7 months in a hospital, and how impossibly hard the whole experience has been.
We've been through more than I can tell you.
There are also efforts to take on that other huge problem, the $12,000 to $15,000 price tag of IVF. So many must pay out of pocket, but even those covered by insurance face limits that can pressure them to take risks. So Joanne Armstrong of Aetna says the insurance company started a new program last year. Women who agree to use just 1 embryo get a 2-for-1.
If they voluntarily try it and they are not successful, the embryos that were created but not used, i.e. put back in the freezer, can be used then in a subsequent cycle.
That is a second single embryo transfer for free. The savings for Aetna are clear. Another IVF is nothing compared to the enormous expense of premature twins. What do the mothers we met at the playdate make of all this? Sharon Bernstein says she wouldn't trade her twin girls for anything, but the push for 1 embryo makes sense.
So I think if I were starting now and I saw that there was a lot of success, I would absolutely try it.
If more women did, experts say it would save hundreds of millions of dollars a year and untold heartache for families. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News.
Artificial food dyes have been around for decades. They're made from petroleum and found in everything from pudding to potato chips. April, this past week, you reported on a few studies that suggest a link between dyes and hyperactivity in kids. So let's take a listen.
Years ago, Christine Woodman wondered whether her kids had ADHD. She noticed Danielle and her brother were having trouble completing even simple projects in elementary school and were way too reckless at home.
It was things like taking sleeping blankets and trying to ski them downstairs.
Her daughter Danielle's 19 now, but she still remembers those days.
It was really fun and funny until I got my head stuck in the wall.
Mom Christine was reluctant at first to take her kids to the doctor, though. She wanted to take a natural approach first. On the advice of friends, Christine cut out foods with artificial coloring. But Danielle didn't really go for it.
I remember dinosaur eggs. They have the oatmeal dinosaur eggs, and they had the little red food dye, little dinosaurs in it. And I remember, if I take those dinosaurs out, can I have the oatmeal?
No, I made the oatmeal with blueberries and soy milk and thought that you would be happy with it.
I was not. That was not a good replacement.
Despite their laughter now, it was tough. And after a year of trying various so-called elimination diets, Christine decided they weren't working. So she went to the doctor. He gave her a prescription for an ADHD medication.
What was stunning to us was the difference.
It was in fourth grade, but I just remember that suddenly it was like my world came back together and I could do stuff.
Danielle went from being the class clown to the class example. Lots of people try diets to address kids' behavior, and many say they work. The diet idea dates back to the 1970s when pediatrician Benjamin Feingold first claimed that there was a link between behavior and food dyes. And let's face it, artificial food dyes aren't essential.
Food dyes are added simply for their color, to make foods fun. They serve no health purpose whatsoever.
That's Michael Jacobson. He heads the Center for Science in the Public Interest. He wants the FDA to ban artificial food dyes like red number 40, yellow number 5, and yellow number 6.
And the reason is that there's substantial evidence that food dyes impair children's behavior, triggering hyperactivity.
But other experts question the evidence. Before today's meeting, the FDA released an analysis that finds no conclusive proof that food dyes cause hyperactivity in most kids. Pediatrician Andrew Addisman of the Cohen Children's Medical Center on Long Island says the studies show a potential link for some kids, but leave a lot of room for doubt.
Some of the studies are difficult or imperfect in that they don't always tease out specific chemicals in isolation.
That's the case with a 2007 British study that has become the center of the debate. 3- and 8-year-olds were given two kinds of drinks that contained a mix of dyes. And afterwards, parents noticed their kids were a lot more hyperactive. But critics of the study say since the dyes were mixed together, it's hard to tell which might be causing a problem. Julie Miller-Jones is a nutritionist at St. Catherine University in St. Paul, Minnesota.
It gives you pause, but it's certainly not convincing evidence that there's a problem.
Pediatrician Addisman says if parents are concerned, cutting out food dyes won't hurt.
We're not putting food coloring into broccoli or other fresh fruits and vegetables, and it's going into processed foods, concentrated sweets, things like that.
Despite concerns with the British study, European lawmakers now require a warning label on foods that contain artificial dyes. Manufacturers over there have turned to natural dyes made from beets and turmeric. But the food industry says they're more expensive and less stable.
Cocoa, candy, shells, fruit flavors in the middle store. Berry, grape, orange, and lime. Taste the rainbow of fruit flavors. Taste the rainbow of fruit flavors.
So, April, you spent much of this past week at the Food and Drug Administration, which is now looking into whether or not there's evidence of a direct link between food dyes and hyperactivity in kids, right?
That's right, Rebecca. I spent a good deal of time in Silver Spring, Maryland this week.
It's a lovely place.
It is. at the meeting of the Food Advisory Committee to the FDA. And they took a look at the evidence and they agreed basically with what the FDA has been suggesting, which is that there is no clear link between food dyes and hyperactivity for most kids.
And now that's based on a couple of studies that have been out for a while now. And they said the studies just aren't really that good. What's wrong with them?
Well, I think just generally it's hard to study kids, mm-hmm. and especially kids and mental health and mental behavior. It's very subjective. But what specifically was wrong with some of these studies, for example, is that there was a mixture of food dyes given to them in different drinks. So it was hard to tell, impossible to tell really which one or ones might be causing a problem because they were all kind of thrown in.
Mm-hmm.
Also, parents observed a level of hyperactivity way beyond what teachers observed in the same kids. So mm-hmm. there wasn't kind of the continuity.
There wasn't consistency there.
Uh-huh. The nerdy word is statistical significance. Uh-huh. So there just wasn't that consistently mm-hmm. throughout.
Because parents are going to see something different than a teacher or educator is going to see.
Of course,
probably.
Of course.
Yeah.
Maybe they're better observers, mm-hmm. or maybe they're biased because they want something to work. I mean, there's mm-hmm. a lot of It's hard to do these kinds of studies,
sure. Right. So what's going to happen from here on out? Will it just be, I mean, Europe, you said in your piece, they've gotten rid of these dyes and are using all natural ones. So in this country, status quo or?
Well, the FDA could go ahead and decide to ask for more studies. They seem particularly interested in blue number one at the meeting. But manufacturers who've been making these products feel vindicated by this committee's decision because they've said all along there's no problem with these. We've tested them for decades, on and on. However, some manufacturers in this country and some large companies are deciding as a marketing issue to sell dye-free products, mm-hmm. like Frito-Lay, like Starbucks. Mm-hmm. So
they're, if you're concerned.
Exactly. They're not saying it's a safety issue. They're saying it's a consumer option.
Great. All right. Well, listen, April, thanks for putting in so much time on this story.
Sure thing.
Okay. So, hi, Scott.
Hey there.
Enthusiastic. That's your word this week, Scott. Enthusiastic health bloggers here with us. How are you?
Doing great.
Good.
What do we want to talk about?
So many options.
Throw me one.
Okay. Well, how about the controversy about the new pharmaceutical company marketing this pretty old preterm labor drug, and they're selling it for quite a bit more money than it's usually sold for.
Back to the FDA. Some very unusual advice from the agency. They came out and told compounding pharmacies, which are these pharmacies that make custom batches of drugs, if you'd like to make your own version of this preterm labor drug, go right ahead. We won't do anything about it. And this ran contrary to what the company KV Pharmaceuticals had been telling these compounding pharmacies. Don't do it. The FDA will come after you. Why? KV just got approval for a new version of an old drug, used to be available for about $15 or $20 a dose. They said they were going to charge $1,500 a dose.
Wow, increase.
Yeah, big increase. People got very upset by that. And so the pressure has been building on the company to do something about it, and the FDA cranked it up even more by saying, look, we're going to essentially allow competition here by encouraging these pharmacies to go ahead and make their own versions. Before KV got approval, by the way, that was a common way that doctors would get the drug.
What's the name of this drug?
It's called Makena.
And it's been in use for
years.
20
it's,
years.
Right.
Or
and what KV did was they went ahead and got formal FDA approval for the medicine for this use. I have an update. Since the blog post, KV has come out and said they're going to cut the price. It's going to be less than $700 a dose now.
Still not quite a bargain.
Right, a little more than half. But, they're sort of mindful of the price pressure, but it's still a big difference. We'll see how it pans out.
Well, compounding pharmacies are sort of this antiquated notion, but I guess they're still around.
Yeah, in the old days, before drug companies were common, it was the pharmacist who was a chemist making these things up to order. And they're still around for custom-made drugs, special kinds of formulations, or things that, you know, have not found a market with big drug companies.
Can you think of an example of something like that, where people might actually need to go to a compounding pharmacy?
You might get a special batch of drug made in a suppository form and instead of a pill.
And up until recently, a lot of dye-free stuff. If you needed dye-free for some medical reason, you could go to a compounding pharmacy. But you had another post that also talked about compounding pharmacies this week.
This is the downside of compounding pharmacies, and that is there have been 9 deaths in Alabama from people who were receiving IV nutrition. They were sick, they were in the hospital, they needed to get fed by IV, and some contaminated nutrition fluids made in a compounding pharmacy have been implicated in this outbreak of 19 people getting bloodstream infections.
Wow. Now, why do they think that happened?
The investigation is ongoing, but the common source in all these illnesses was one pharmacy that was preparing IV fluids for a bunch of hospitals in Alabama. So that's the common source. All the stuff's been recalled. That pharmacy isn't supplying the hospitals anymore, and the health officials in Alabama said there's no additional risk that they believe is out there, but it's the notion that if you're doing something in a compounding pharmacy, it can be done properly, but it's not the same as a big sterile drug factory, and so there is the potential for problems.
They're not regulated the same way.
Not as tightly, that's right.
So, Scott, another post that caught our eye was titled, Doctors Should Ask Kids. Are you on Facebook?
The leading pediatricians group has come out with advice to doctors, telling them, look, it's important for the health of children to know what they're doing online. That's how they socialize. That's also a window into their mental health. And so they want doctors to ask kids, what are you doing online? And they also want pediatricians to talk to parents to say, make sure you know what your kids are doing, get involved.
And based on another post you had, they might also want to ask, does your child play an instrument?
Yeah, we had a lot of bacteria posts this week, and I think this one
took... Very germy.
This one took the Gross Out Award. Some researchers in Oklahoma tested 13 different instruments to look for mold, bacteria, all kinds of germs, and shocker, they found quite a bit in brass and woodwind instruments. And the bottom line is, parents, if your kids are going to play in the band, just make sure that they clean the instruments. It's also possible to have the instruments sterilized. We point out in the post that the research was funded by someone who has a financial interest in a company that sterilizes instruments. It doesn't invalidate the findings. It's pretty clear that this is an issue, but there are ways to keep these instruments clean, and it's probably a good idea to do that regularly.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Mr. Germ.
I think I'll go wash my hands now.
Okay.
Thanks a lot, Scott.
And that is, of course, Scott Hensley.
Some researchers say a non-medical remedy for back pain can be very effective. It's a series of posture lessons called the Alexander Technique. It was devised by a 19th century Australian actor. And Sarah Varney of member station KQED in San Francisco has more.
Those bright, powerful notes from the revival of a chorus line are a lot of work. And hitting those notes night after night in a cramped orchestra pit takes a toll on the musicians.
The fact of having your arms up, carrying the weight of this instrument, and pushing the instrument towards you. And so you have this stress, you have this sort of wall that you're pushing against. And a well-designed instrument will sort of push back.
If you ever saw Wicked in San Francisco or Cats on the Road, you've probably heard Joe Rodriguez blasting on his trumpet. I met him at the Musicians Union Hall in downtown San Francisco. He's been a working trumpet player for 4 decades, and all that back arching and shoulder pinching has left him with chronic pain in his lower back. He tried massage, chiropractic, and powerful painkillers, but he says it was only through Alexander Technique lessons did he train his body to move in a way that eased his aching back.
It's a feeling of working with yourself from the inside out. If you know that you're twisting a certain way or using too much force, it's easy enough to know, let that go.
I wasn't really sure what Joe meant, so we took a listen to one of his trumpet solos.
And talk about how, when you're doing this kind of solo, how you're holding yourself differently now because of learning the Alexander Technique.
Now I know that I can just sort of be, so what they call under sits bones on the hip, you know, instead of maybe some funny arch or with my stomach pushed out or my back arched some strange way.
We're just going to let the neck be free here. Let the head move forward and up and yes.
I'm on my hands and knees next to Josephine Gray, trying to relearn how to stand up. Joe, as she likes to be called, teaches the technique and says low back pain is a common complaint of clients.
We would look at what you are doing that causes that problem in the first place. How you sit at the computer or how you pick up your child or what you're doing when you're driving. I definitely look at ways of changing your postural habits so that you don't get into pain.
These aren't static postures, though. Those who promote the technique say it's more about how you move and training yourself to release tension. These are subtle, tiny, almost imperceptible shifts. And although the teacher will put her hand on your neck or shoulder, it's more to bring awareness than to make adjustments.
No, the whole point is that you understand the process so that you can arrive there yourself. Mm-hmm.
Joe the teacher and Joe the trumpet player both say the lessons are no cure-all, but there is evidence it can ease chronic low back pain over the long run. Paul Little is a primary care researcher at the University of Southampton in Britain. He led a study of some 460 patients who were given Alexander lessons or massage or the usual care of painkillers and exercise. After a year, those who had massage were no better off. Those who had 6 Alexander lessons showed some improvement, and those who went the distance got the best results.
The people who'd had 24 lessons had gone down from about 21 days in pain that the usual care group reported to about 3 days in pain. So a really dramatic difference there in reported days in pain.
Little's research was published in the British Medical Journal in 2008, but now he wants to figure out why it appears to work. He's about to start a new study that involves giving chronic back pain sufferers lessons in the Alexander technique and exercises, and then measuring how far their spines can twist and the size and strength of their deep lumbar muscles, which Little thinks might work poorly in people with chronic low back pain. He cautions, though, that it may be something else entirely that accounts for the apparent success of the Alexander technique. If that's the case, Little says he'll have to go back to the drawing board. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Varney. And now, a common misconception about knees. Something jogging eventually breaks the knee joint down and causes pain. But experts who study running say it's not so. NPR's Patty Naiman explains why.
Paul Ryder loves to run on Mulholland Drive in Hollywood.
Fantastic view. Had a lot of rain, so you can see the whole San Fernando Valley. It's beautiful. It's a great place to run.
Ryder doesn't just run for exercise.
It's a nice emotional release, a nice stress release.
Ryder runs a 7 to 8 minute mile. His wife, Lyra, runs a little slower, but pretty much for the same reasons.
I do enjoy running. I like getting out. It always feels great when you've done it.
Lyra and Paul Ryder are in their mid-40s, about the age when health experts used to say
that if you jogged and jogged and ran, that you'd be doing in your knees.
Dr. David Felsen at Boston University School of Medicine says the concern was degeneration of the knee and arthritis. But when researchers actually studied the impact of running on knees, that's not what they found.
When we look at people with knee arthritis, we don't find much of a previous history of running. And when we look at runners and follow them over time, we don't find that their risk of developing osteoarthritis is increased any more than would be expected.
So from both types of studies, the message is the same. Running won't hurt the knees even when you're older. And a new analysis of 28 studies from around the world, which included nearly 10,000 people, concluded the same thing. In one study, researchers from Sweden found it may be even beneficial. They looked at exercise, including running, to see what happened to cartilage, that gooey substance which connects bones and muscle. Dr. Felsen.
They took people at risk of osteoarthritis and took one group and exercised it and the other group and didn't. And they did imaging of the joint that looks at the biochemistry of cartilage, where the disease may start. And they found that the biochemistry, which was abnormal at the beginning, actually improved a little bit in those who were running, suggesting that running was healthy to the joint.
It could be the impact of the body weight when the foot hits the ground stimulates production of certain proteins in the cartilage, which make it stronger, in the same way exercise like running makes bones and muscles stronger. And cartilage health may turn out to be really important.
We are now starting to understand that there is some loss of cartilage annually.
Dr. Nancy Lane is a rheumatologist at the University of California. She did some of the first studies of runners and knee arthritis.
If you have a relatively normal knee and you're jogging 5 to 6 times a week at a moderate pace, then there's every reason to believe that your joints will remain healthy.
But there are some caveats. If you've had a significant knee injury, especially one that required surgery, then Lane says running can increase your risk of arthritis. So can running really fast, like a 5 or 6 minute mile, for example, or lots of really long runs like marathons. Best advice, says Lane, running in moderation, about 40 minutes a day, an 8 to 10 minute mile. And if you're more than 20 pounds overweight, Lane says don't start start suddenly running. All that extra weight can cause real damage, inflammation, bony spurs, and cartilage thinning.
If somebody is heavy and they want to start exercising, I don't have them go off running. I have them walk and walk until they're to a point where I think that their body mass is reduced enough that it won't traumatize their joints.
So for Paul and Lyra Ryder, who aren't overweight and hope to run the rest of their lives, scientists agree. Just go for it. Patty Neiman, NPR News.
And that's all for Your Health, NPR's weekly podcast. We had production assistance from our intern, Adam Cole.
And our health blogger, Scott Hensley. You can see all the newest blog posts or browse through our archives at npr.org/shots. We'll be back again next week.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.